I'm speaking to Tom and Jen, who I believe have a very interesting story to tell. Could you describe the situation when you brought your when you originally brought your 7-year-old daughter in for treatment?
She was in first grade and she wasn't speaking in school. That was my main concern. There were areas outside of school she wasn't speaking as well, but school was my main concern. She would only whisper to a few select students. She wouldn't talk to the teacher. She wouldn't participate in any type of group activities. She would stand by and observe. And I was concerned that this would affect her academically and socially.
When was it that you first became aware of the term selective mutism?
When Sarah was in preschool, she wouldn't talk. She would cry every time I dropped her off, and she would stand by and observe. She wouldn't participate, just like she wouldn't in first grade. She was evaluated by a speech therapist. Every child in the preschool was evaluated, and the speech therapist told me that she thought she may be she may have selective mutism. So I looked it up, and she fit the bill.
How was this situation impacting you as parents? Well, when you saw your daughter struggling with anxiety and selective mutism, how was it affecting you? What were you thinking? What were you going through?
It gave me anxiety. I just didn't know why she didn't want to talk. I everyone told me, oh, she's just shy. She'll come out of it. Give her time. She'll grow out of it. We brought her to see a social worker, local here in our town, and she would just sit down and talk to her and play with toys, and it really didn't do anything. So,
at what point were you guys really concerned about what you saw?
Very early, I would think. We were concerned very early.
We were concerned in kindergarten. I think that's when we brought her to that other lady, and
even before that. We were earlier than that. When she was in preschool, we were concerned. We were very concerned when she was around, how old? Yeah, prior to kindergarten.
Yeah, she was probably 4 years old.
We saw some things going on. And then 5 years old. And then, of course, you know, you try to do things with her and change her ways, and it failed. It wasn't working. And you consulted with... you had relatives and friends, so she's just shy, it's just this, she'll grow out of it, it's just a phase. But overall, it just continued on the same path, and we just could not figure it out. Until eventually Jennifer came across someone, like she said, who pointed us in the right direction,
gave us
the right idea.
I actually did some research on the internet, and I found somebody local. She was over here, closer to us, and she said she specialized in selective mutism, so we went to her. And that wasn't working, and then we stopped that, and I did some more research, and then that's when I found you.
Okay, just 10 seconds on when you took her to this other person who worked with selective mutism. Are you aware of what that person was trying to do with her?
No, I am not, actually. We would go into her little office, and Sarah would sit there and play with toys and color. I think at first she just nodded to her, and eventually she talked to her, like, whispered, just minimally. I mean, she was just asking everyday things. I don't even know what she was doing with her.
Do you remember how long you went to this person?
We may have visited her 3 times over the course of 3 months, perhaps, or 4 months. How long was it, Jen?
We probably went about
four times. Okay.
But you were seeing, I don't mean to lead you too much, but you were seeing that things were not working, I'm assuming?
She wasn't giving us any direction on what to do.
Okay.
So when she would just, you know, ask Sarah the same questions over and over again, and Sarah would either whisper to me what the answers were, she would ask her, who's your best friend, what do you like to do in school, you know, but she wasn't giving us any direction, and she would say, oh, next time I'll give you some information on what you should do. So I felt like we were hitting a dead end, so... I stopped going there.
Okay, that's a key phrase, direction for the parents. Now, before we get into direction, where is your daughter at currently? How would you describe her situation?
I would say she's at 100%. at 100% being a 7-year-old child.
I would say 99%, but she's talking in school. The only I actually had the assistant principal come up to me yesterday and say, "I can't believe your daughter. She's talking, she's chatting, she's a different child. She came out of her shell," she said. She's talking in every aspect. The only problem, the teacher said, is she wishes her volume would be a little bit louder. That's why I said 99%. But she's a social butterfly.
Okay, so 99%, 100% social butterfly.
Mm-hmm.
Now I want to talk for a few minutes about the process of how you achieved your objectives. And it's all about, you used the key word for the listeners, there's going to be a lot of people who are going to hear this, is giving the parents direction. It was my objective in working with you that I was, in essence, teaching you guys to be the therapists. I think that our total treatment was somewhere around 15 sessions over approximately a year, a little more. And in that period of time, I believe she came to my office actually only 3 times. The rest of the time was just the parents. Now, that's very important for the parents who are listening to this right now. This progress was achieved 98% via interaction with the parents, teaching them direction, teaching them a game plan. So we're going to go through the steps slowly in a few minutes. I mean, within the next few minutes. Okay, now the first thing that we did was educating you to the fact that obviously selective mutism is an anxiety problem and it's a variation of obsessive compulsive disorder. And the first thing after that was for the two of you to be as unified, to be on the same team, not that you weren't before, but to really refine your parenting philosophy and technique to be on the same team. Because it's important for the child to perceive that. The more that things are meticulously organized, the more productivity you will be. Can you comment on that for a moment, being on the same team?
We never really had a problem. We were always on the same team. But, yeah, definitely she had to know that we both were going to be on the same team. One of them wasn't going to enable her more than the other one. We had a set of expectations that now she had to follow, and she couldn't go to one knowing that she can get what she wanted from one and not the other.
Okay. I feel learning that, learning how to jump in, get into her more, and find out her feelings, and speak to her on a different level to bring her open and, you know, express herself more was actually an enjoyable thing, to be able to get in there and speak with her. And bond with her, you know, and pull her out of a shell by talking with her and finding out her feelings and hearing what she had to say, and to get her to express herself and explain her feelings, basically.
Okay, now you said that two pieces here. Let's first do the enabling piece. Just talk a little bit about how you guys stopped the enabling.
She was very dependent, overly dependent on us. For everyday situation stuff like falling asleep, she slept in our bed at that point. She was sleeping with us. We would have to answer questions for her. She wouldn't go up and down the stairs in her bedroom to get something. If she wanted something, she wanted us to do it. Simple things like when she got in the car, she was perfectly able to buckle her own seatbelt, but she wanted us to buckle it.
Lots of things, yeah.
Okay, so what I want the listeners to understand here, that what they're describing is not only enabling is defined as any behavior on the part of caregivers that inhibits the potential or growth of the child.
Right.
And it's not just speaking for the child, it's getting the child to access part of the brain that the child doesn't want to go to because it causes anxiety or it's difficult. It's teaching independent skills at an age-appropriate level. When it came time to really put in motion not talking for her, like someone comes up and says, sweetie, what's your name? And then there's a blank stare.
Right, absolutely.
Talk about that and talk about your own emotions that you had to deal with in order to be successful.
Well, we had to, if I'd be at the grocery store and somebody would, the grocery clerk or somebody would ask her a question, she would, you know, look down or look at me, expecting me to answer for her. you instructed us that we had to freeze the moment. We had to wait 10 to 15 seconds for her to try to answer. We had to tell her that she had to try. And initially, you know, I would just sit there and wait the 10 seconds and I would have to answer for her. But
it was embarrassing at times. You know, it felt, it felt weird. It's a strange feeling.
Yeah,
you know,
the person looks at you like, okay, your child's rude or she doesn't talk. It would give me anxiety. Her anxiety would give me anxiety, but...
Yeah, but what? Given this specific dynamic, what advice would you give the parents? Because it's very hard for the parents in general who have selectively mute kids to be able to do this freezing the moment and verbal non-enabling. What would you say to parents who are listening to this?
What would we say to them? With regard to handling it, I guess, afterwards by being educated by you, freezing that moment. Well, in freezing of the moment, obviously, Jennifer said it. You stay, you wait 10 seconds, you try to allow your daughter to see how the moment takes place and how it should be taken care of on her own. She should be responding. She should be, paying attention, and she should be finding that place that she's uncomfortable in. And then afterwards, we would speak to her about that. We would talk to her about that situation that she was in. We would bring up that moment. We would bring up what were her feelings at that time, and try to bring her out of that shell, or bring her into that place in her mind or her brain that open it up, open that door to say, at that moment, what were you feeling, and to understand what the feelings were at the time, so she can know
connect
with those feelings that usually turn the switch on to the anxiety and that to shut her off completely.
So, in other words, what you're saying is that while it was difficult to go through the process of this non-enabling, there was a really productive payoff for it.
Oh, it was very difficult, because Jennifer and I, it was difficult because we were used to being there for her. And, it's your child. You're there for her. You love her. You're taking care of her. You want to do everything and anything you can in your power to make sure she's safe and she's comfortable. And at the same time, you think to yourself, oh, geez. She should be doing this on her own, or she should be, then you sort of start to get a little tired of certain things that you're doing.
But
so the enabling was definitely, by withdrawing on the enabling, pulling back on that was a good point.
Oh, Tom, I want to point out, I really appreciate your feedback, because I hate to be sexist, but usually it's, in 95% of the cases, it's the mom who does most of the work, but you were really in here on the clinical front line, and you did a great job with the parenting, and I hope that, and I know that there's a lot of fathers out there who can appreciate what you're saying. This process of helping her identify her feelings, how hard or easy was that?
It was hard doing it on a daily basis because sometimes she would just have the same answers all the time, but we would just have to have her identify with how she's feeling in certain situations, even everyday things like, being happy, being sad, being mad, being angry. She had to just connect that those are normal feelings and she had to connect with them. And
us as parents, our goal was to play that role and be that and I guess therapeutize or be there like you expressed. You made sure that we were there to speak to our daughter every day, all the time, a couple times a day, try to get inside her, try to find out what happened at that particular moment at school or that particular moment on the bus or at the store. And in doing that, sure, that was a difficult process. We were being trained, and we were there to continually find out from her, because we were there with her 24/7, and to help her.
Okay, now there's just two more points I want to touch on here within the next 5 minutes here. Okay, now we did in this situation use medicine. Some people who are going to listen to this interview are going to be open to this idea. Some are not. But what's very, very important is that the listeners understand how we used it. So I'm going to explain it, and if you disagree with anything that I say, please, you know, tell me after. We did not start with medicine right away. That is the biggest mistake that people make. This is not a medical disorder. Okay, this is an emotional problem that does have physiological ramifications. We used the medicine, a low dose of medicine, at a specific time. I believe it was a few months into therapy, and this was only after she was programmed for a new set of expectations, meaning that she knew she was not going to be enabled. You got her to the point that she was trying but kind of stuck.
Yes.
Did I say that right?
That's correct.
Okay.
Yep.
And then we used the medicine, and what did you start seeing with the medicine?
We saw that she started to have less anxiety. She started to appear to be a little more confident.
Comfortable.
And she started talking in school, which was a big step.
Okay, and then I'm going to get to school in a moment. And then what we did was we used the medicine for a specific period of time, and we started methodically, and methodically is a very important word here. We methodically took her off the medicine after she had sustained an ongoing level of success.
Yes.
And when we took her off the medicine, you saw what?
She was able to, she was very comfortable. She became more confident. She was talking. She was talking at school. She was talking in places where we always found, strange, whether it was supermarkets, whether even with family, certain family members she opened up to. And, of course, school was the main thing, as Jennifer said earlier. Her academics bloomed, you know. She did much better.
Okay, so what we did was specific medicine for specific reasons, for a specific length of time, the overall objective of which is to have her not need the medicine. So parents, listen, when you think, the parents who are listening to this interview, when you think that medicine is the answer and you run out and you go get medicine and you don't do the parenting work, I'm going to go on record as saying that's clinically criminal behavior, and it's desperate behavior on the part of the parents. It's also desperate behavior on the part of the therapists and psychiatrists who give medicine without doing the parenting work, at the risk of being too controversial. Now, one more point here. You are identifying most of the problem as being in school. She was not talking in select situations out of the school, and you
Absolutely.
Did see social inhibition outside of school, but there was a great deal of muteness in school.
Yes.
And what I said was, we're not going to go into school until we're not going to try to teach the teachers what to do until, on a scale of 1 to 10, you guys get to a 7 with your new parenting technique.
Right. That's right.
Because we don't want to flood her with too much stress. We want to get her ready, okay? So then at that point, when we were at a 7, we did talk to the teacher, and she was very responsive. And can you just shed a little insight in a minute or so about what happened in school, Mom?
Her teacher at the time was very into helping her. She wanted to help her speak, so she was very open to any suggestions you had. I believe you spoke with her on a couple of occasions, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. She was just open, and she did whatever you asked her to do.
Okay, and what we did was she wrote a few reports, and Mom also, Mom and Dad, I want the other, again, the listeners to hear the important points here. In between sessions, you got into somewhat of a routine of emailing me. This is a part of treatment. Emailing me what was going on with your non-enabling, and what was going good, and what you were struggling with, and the whole process of helping her identify feelings and thoughts. Okay, because being meticulously organized is a very important part of this process. So now that treatment is over and she's off medicine and you've gone through the whole process, how are your lives different?
She's independent. I have two other children, so they take up all my time. Sarah's not taking up any of my time anymore. She's independent. She's social. She'd rather be out on other people's places, other people's houses, sleepovers. I look back at some of the notes I had taken about how dependent she was on us, and it seems like it's a lifetime away. I'm just so happy that now she is who she is.
Dad, you want to add anything?
Yes, it's a great feeling. It definitely is. There's a bright light at the end of the tunnel. She's a wonderful child. She just loves to play and do things and play with friends and have a good time. And of course, at the same time, you know that she's going to be able to express herself and talk to other parents when she's with her friends, and she talks and she asks and she. So she's safe now. You know she's safe and she's taking care of herself in the independent way, as Jennifer said. You know, she's able to communicate, which is fabulous. It's fabulous. It makes us feel great.
Okay, so let's end on that note. Listen, guys, I want to thank you very much for sharing. You're going to help a lot of people by giving your input with this interview.
Great.
Thank you very much.
No problem.